Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and heads up if you live in Rockland or the Bronx. We're into the last few weeks of your anecdotal census, a people's history of the New York City area from 2000 to 2010. If you want to participate, just go to our website and answer the question, the biggest change in my neighborhood over the last 10 years has been what? We have a separate page for each county in our listening area. We invite your posts from wherever. So many conversations already started and ongoing there. But our next two on-air segments will be about Rockland County and the Bronx. Rockland this Thursday, the Bronx next week. We want all our Bronx and Rockland listeners to go to the page and fill in the blank. The biggest change in my neighborhood over the last 10 years has been what? We'll talk on the air about how Rockland County has changed on this Thursday show. Then the Bronx, next week, join us in creating your anecdotal census, a people's history of the New York City area from 2000 to 2010. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. Well, what the bank reform bill didn't change, according to my next guest, is Wall Street's cultural shift from taking risks with their own money to taking risks with other people's money. So will the 2,300-page Dodd-Frank bill make us any safer from another bubble and crash born of too much irresponsible risk-taking? Will the fraud settlement with Goldman Sachs do it either? William Cohen is contributing editor at Fortune, former Wall Street banker, and author of the book House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street. And you may have seen his recent op-ed piece in The Times called Let Goldman Be Goldman. Hey, William, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Always great to be here.
First, what did you mean by let Goldman be Goldman?
Well, you know, as many people will, of course, remember that if it hadn't been for the decision in late September of 2008 to allow both Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley to become bank holding companies, previously they had just been securities firms, and as a result of becoming bank holding companies, they immediately got access to Fed funding like a bank, which allowed them to get very cheap access to very inexpensive money that they could then use to make money off of money, and in effect got a huge subsidy from the American taxpayers. And by allowing them to do that, without requiring them to change their business plan, in other words, there's been no change. Goldman hasn't become any less of, you know, people accuse them of being a hedge fund. They don't like that, but they make so much money from proprietary trading and proprietary bets that, in effect, the American people were subsidizing that business plan. I mean, they don't take deposits like Chase or Bank of America. They take this money that they're getting from the Fed, and they make big bets on it, and they're very good at it, and so they make a lot of money based on that. So my point was, why are we continuing to do that? Why are we giving Goldman Sachs that kind of subsidy, which they're then using to make a lot of money and pay themselves big bonuses? If they want to do that kind of business, you know, God bless them, I guess. If they want to use the famous Lloyd Blankfein assertion that he was doing God's work, you know, let them do that. But let's not, as American taxpayers, subsidize that activity anymore. And so that was the point of that article, which I'm not sure I made clearly enough, because a lot of people thought that I was somehow saying, you know, that Goldman should, you know, escape from any oversight or regulation. I'm not saying that at all. They will continue to be regulated.
The headline writer should have written force Goldman to be Goldman.
that could be it too, right? In other words, let them go. But if they want to take those kinds of risks with their own money or their shareholders' money or their creditors' money, then, you know, let them. Let's just not, as American taxpayers, subsidize that anymore.
By the way, their version of that history, I think, is that since they were still profitable, even while the other big investment firms were in such hot water, that they were forced or coerced by the government into joining the TARP program and relabeling themselves a bank holding company because the government didn't want to make it look like, you know, certain companies were weaker than other companies. So as part of their strategy to shore up the whole system, they asked Goldman, kind of pushed Goldman into also taking that new designation when they didn't want to and didn't want to take TARP money. Do you think that's an accurate version?
Well, there are two points that you made. Let me just break them apart for a minute. One was the decision by former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, formerly also a CEO of Goldman Sachs before becoming Treasury Secretary, to force a group of banks, nine banks, I believe, take TARP money, and that came in October of 2008. And Goldman received $10 billion at that meeting and, you know, has later claimed that they didn't want it or didn't need it. And, yes, I think the idea behind that moment in time was to sort of re-equitize, recapitalize, reliquify this group of big banks and make sure that they don't run into problems again, sort of reestablish the confidence that was quickly deteriorating in the banking sector. So I want to set that idea aside from what happened in September earlier, a few weeks earlier, when both Goldman and Morgan Stanley actually requested from the Federal Reserve to become bank holding companies so that they could also shore up the confidence that investors had in them by making it clear that they had access to this Fed money.
And does the Fed continue to lend to the big banks at almost zero interest rates? And are they only eligible for that if they're in this category of bank holding company?
Yes, they continue to do that. You know, I don't know whether it's billions or trillions of dollars. They really don't make public who and how much they lend to on a regular basis, although there's some effort to change that. So, yes, Goldman Sachs is still getting this benefit. Morgan Stanley is still getting this benefit, as are, you know, a group of big U.S. banks. And before that, I mean, one of the things that came out of this crisis was that the old model of being a securities firm, which, you know, which was what Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, Bear Stearns, and Lehman Brothers were, securities firms, they had to get their funding, by and large, from public sources, not from the Fed. They had to go to the market and get their financing. That's why Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers ended up going out of business. That's why Merrill Lynch ended up having to sell itself to Bank of America that famous September 15th weekend, is because they could no longer get access to funding from the public markets because nobody had confidence in them anymore that they were going to stay open and stay open for business. So what's happened that, you know, a lot of people don't talk about, but in the last 2 years, what's happened is that the Fed has gotten more and more willing to lend money to what had formerly been known as securities firms in exchange for securities as collateral, or, you know, whether it's treasuries, and eventually it became mortgage securities and all sorts of other squirrely securities, so that the Fed, whose balance sheet expanded from $800 billion before this crisis to over $2 trillion now, has taken on a lot of the risk that was formerly in the banking system.
William Cohen, my guest on WNYC, author of the book House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street. And maybe you saw his recent op-ed in the New York Times called Let Goldman Be Goldman. Our phone number, 212-433-WNYC. And Eli in Dover, you're on WNYC with William Cohen. Hello.
Hi. The government legislation, as far as I can tell, is really just doubling down on the problem, because when you think about it, the problem was really the housing bubble. They gave bad loans to people who could never afford to pay them, which was really a government legislation in the first place. The banks did not want to make those loans, and there were a lot of politicians, Barack Obama.
Well, are you talking about Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae loans?
Yeah, not only that, even private banks. Barack Obama, as a community organizer, was pressuring them to make loans to people just because of a racial issue, people who could not afford to pay them. And as far as I can tell, this legislation, all it does is just give the government more responsibility for the banks. It brings the government in much more into running banks. The government takes over much more responsibility for the banks.
Eli, you don't think that that's blaming the poor for the sins of the rich? And racializing it nonetheless, trying to blame black people and Hispanic people by name, you just about did, there's a lot of that out there today, for the problems on Wall Street of the way massive numbers of these mortgages were securitized?
Well, I'm blaming everybody involved. The people who took the mortgages who could never pay them, and the politicians who insisted that they be given the mortgages, and the banks who were at least willing, they didn't put up enough of a fuss about making such loans. Everybody who's involved is to blame. Everybody who did something wrong over here, and the government should be getting, should not have done this in the first place. The legislation they need now is to undo the old problems. The problem is that Barney Frank, who was involved in creating this mess, is the one who's writing the reform, and so he didn't address the real issue. Instead, he gave the government more responsibility for financial institutions. Officially, this whole legislation is just to get the government out of responsibility. And instead of that, they're just giving the government more responsibility, that the government would have to take over more institutions, they would have to take them over in a broader way. And the government is not capable of running these kinds of institutions.
William Cullen, talk to Eli in Dover.
Well, I think Eli makes some valid points, no doubt about it. I mean, it wasn't just, I mean, the Obama administration inherited the political goals that were very much on the mind of both Bill Clinton and George Bush, which was to increase the number of homeowners in this country. That was very much on the political agenda of both the Clinton and Bush administrations. And Obama, rather than necessarily endorsing that, sort of cleaned up, was forced to clean up the mess that they left. And the idea was that, you know, homeownership is part of the American dream. And so both Clinton and Bush pushed banks to make more and more loans to people who had been renters before. And as a result, they ended up making a tremendous number of mortgages available to people who actually couldn't afford the homes that they wanted to buy and couldn't afford to pay back the mortgages they agreed to take out. Now, nobody should be, in my opinion, should be taking out a mortgage that they can't, or borrowing any money that they can't successfully agree to pay back and can't knowingly know that they're going to be able to pay it back. So that's a mistake, but the mistake was absolutely compounded by, you know, in typical Wall Street fashion, by the creativity and the cleverness, if you will, of packaging up all these mortgages and selling, and turning them into securities and selling them to investors all over the world. So had that not happened, that was like an accelerant on the fire. Had that not happened, then this process, this crisis would have been much narrower in focus instead of sort of a worldwide systemic problem. So there is some blame to be apportioned to people who took mortgages that they could not afford to pay back. Now, a lot of them will say, well, we didn't understand the kind of mortgages we were taking out, and we didn't understand that they were going to become, you know, higher interest rate mortgages because they were adjustable. But, you know, I think it's on the obligation of every one of us as citizens to make sure we read the fine print of what we're doing. I mean, we can't live beyond our means. That's one of the valuable lessons I think we've learned from this, although that's always a short-lived lesson, unfortunately.
Right. But beyond that, to get to the systemic impact on the whole economy, I mean, would we really be going through this economic shock in America right now with persistent 10% unemployment, et cetera, rather than just these individuals who took mortgages that they couldn't afford facing foreclosure? Were it not for the folks on Wall Street, I mean, is it wrong to say that Fannie and Freddie, like any lender, weren't going to keep making riskier and riskier housing loans if the guys on Wall Street hadn't been willing to buy them, no matter what the risk profile, to securitize them for bigger gains? Because we hear, just like Eli called and said, several guests on our show recently, John Fund from the Wall Street Journal editorial page, and another guest who's the head of the conservative think tank, the American Enterprise Institute, want to come back to Fannie and Freddie and the help to poor people, which Eli said that meant people of color, and that's the implication that's out there, is the thing that crashed the economy.
Brian, there's no question that without Wall Street's cleverness to package up all these mortgages into securities, which began, by the way, in the early 80s with a guy named Lou Ranieri at Salomon Brothers, who had this idea. And like any good idea on Wall Street, it's always, unfortunately, taken to an extreme position until a bubble is created and it bursts. And that's what happened here. That's what happened with high-yield junk bonds. That's what happened with Internet IPOs. That's what happened with emerging telecom debt. This is a familiar pattern on Wall Street. and absolutely was aided and abetted by Fannie and Freddie, who, don't forget, were public companies with their own public shareholders that were hoping that on every quarter Fannie and Freddie would make more and more money and the stock price would go up. So Fannie's incentive, Freddie's incentive, was to approve more of these loans, to securitize them itself, and to effect start competing with Wall Street to securitize and package these mortgages. It was all a huge gravy train that I think was motivated by the way Wall Street is now structured, which is this whole idea that you mentioned at the top of the show about how the incentives on Wall Street are to take risks with other people's money, knowing that if it pays off, you're going to get a big bonus, and if it doesn't, you know, it turns out you get bailed out by the government, and then a year later you make big bonuses all over again. And by the way, nothing in the 2,300 pages of this bill that's about to be turned into law addresses that situation, and I think that is a major flaw of the legislation.
Therefore what? Therefore we're not much safer from the risk of a bubble and a crash than we were last week?
I don't think we are in the slightest. We have all these sort of bells and whistles. There's a Consumer Protection Agency, which, you know, supposedly is going to inform the populace about the risks they are taking if they are unable to inform themselves. You've got some derivatives being traded on an exchange. But basically, even, you know, the Volcker Rule was tremendously watered down. The Wall Street lobbyists in Washington did a tremendous job. They haven't been given the full credit yet for the job they did in watering down this bill, which is hard to imagine given that there's 2,300 pages. But no, not one iota is of the bill is going to change the way Wall Street compensates its best performers, the way the incentives work on Wall Street. One thing is for sure, there will not be in the near term any mortgage-related financial crisis. Just like after, you know, the 1987 crash, there wasn't a high yield, a junk bond related crisis in the next, you know, now it's been 23 years. Wall Street is very good at not creating the same mistakes over again in the specifics, i.e., not going to be a junk bond crisis, not going to be a mortgage crisis, because the market just pulls away from any excess so dramatically that it takes years and years for anything like that to occur again. But there will be another crisis of origin we can't even imagine yet, because that's the way, you know, Wall Street works. I mean, you know, as I like to say, why do scorpions sting? They sting because that's what they do. Why does Wall Street do this? Because there's no incentive not to.
You know, that call really got the rest of our listeners going, and now our board is full, just as we're running out of time shortly, with people who want to talk about Fannie and Freddie versus Wall Street as the underlying reasons for the crash. This is a hot button issue in America, and this is going to be a hot button issue in the midterm elections. It's probably a Tea Party staple, and William, this is really just beginning to be played out as an issue at the populist level, don't you think?
I absolutely agree, and it's exacerbated by the fact that this bill, this 2,300 pages, doesn't address what happened at Fannie and Freddie. Doesn't address how to take Fannie and Freddie out of receivership, how to either wind them down or allow them to continue. I mean, people say, well, that's, you know, the ball has been pushed down the road, but absolutely Fannie and Freddie had a role in this. But, you know, there were a lot of other players. I mean, one thing the caller was right about, there's a lot of blame to go around here, and that is a point that Alan Schwartz, the former CEO of Bear Stearns, at the end of the firm's existence, made to me in the book, and it's the last sort of page and a half of the book, is about all the blame that is to go around here. And by the way, no one's been held accountable for it.
Here's one more caller, I think, on another side of it than Eli was. Patrick, calling from New Mexico. Is that right, Patrick?
That's correct. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Listen, I'm formerly from Seacliff, Long Island. I live out here in the last 4 years. When I bought my first house in 1989, I bought it with my girlfriend at the time. We needed $25,000 to turn the key to get in. I had $17,500. My girlfriend had $7,500 saved. But she worked off the books or what have her and had no way of justifying a pay. And I've been paying taxes, doing home improvements to try to show my thing. We hired through our real estate agent, a mortgage broker through him, and this fella, I guess in his $1,800 suit, four-door Mercedes, and his gold rings, he was going to make this happen no matter what. And what they ended up doing for us, and I was never comfortable with this, was fudging pay slips or whatever to make it happen, to show that we had enough income combined. I think it was $65,000 at the time to make it happen in 1989. And what I saw was, and again, not knowing all this other stuff behind the scenes until it fell, was that this fellow that represented the bank, I guess he got a point or 2 points to make the closing on it, but they were going to close it at all costs.
So people had their incentive. Did you say this was in 1989?
This is when I bought my first house at 31, yes.
All right, Patrick, thank you very much. But something in our last minute, William, something changed in the 2000s where that kind of practice, and that sounds like it was illegal, they were fudging pay slips and stuff like that. But something changed.
There was a lot of that this time around, too, by the way.
Something changed to grease the wheels so that there was incentive for banks to give mortgages that they knew were more risky, right? Because they just sold them off their books, which didn't happen in 1989.
Well, certainly not to the extent that it happened in the last 10 years. I mean, it became a huge business on Wall Street in the last 10 years with every Wall Street firm getting involved. And Goldman Sachs was by, you know, hardly the largest. But I mean, that gets back to this idea that, that was pushed by the Clinton administration and the Bush administration about the importance of home ownership being part of the American dream. And if you go on the Internet, you can see plenty of examples of Clinton and Bush giving speeches talking about this. And it trickled down throughout their administration to the banking sector, who was basically forced or highly encouraged to make these loans and mortgages available.
So the new American dream is affordable rent?
Well, I mean, it should be not living beyond your means. Let's live within our means for a change and see what that feels like, just like our grandparents did coming out of the Depression. I mean, it made for a very powerful country for many, many years because we didn't get ourselves into this fiscal mess that we're in now.
William Cohen. That's C-O-H-A-N, contributing editor at Fortune, former Wall Street banker, author of the book House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street. And you may have seen his recent op-ed piece in The Times called Let Goldman Be Goldman. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Up next, we'll take a few minutes to ask, should you stop exercising in the heat and bad air? Stay with us.